This morning we turn to Revelation chapter 13 as we're studying the interlude, the third interlude of the book, a parenthesis in the action of judgment that is represented by the seven sealed book. There's some discussion on where verse 17 should go, that is, of chapter 12, verse 17. It could go with chapter 13 and be verse 1, or it could remain there where it's at. Remember, there were no chapter divisions when this book was originally written by John. So let's not think of the chapter division as being some break in the vision that we are receiving here in chapter 12 and 13. So I would say verse 17 is a transition verse. It's connecting the two chapters. And both of these chapters concern the war of the dragon on the woman and her seed. In chapter 12, verses 13 to 16, we saw the dragon turning his rage on the woman after Christ's ascension, which was stated in verse 5 of chapter 12. Satan failed in his designs against Christ. He sought to defeat Christ, who was the seed of the woman, promised of God. But he was unable to do so. Christ fulfilled his work, and he was exalted to the right hand of God in heaven. And so Christ was out of his sphere. The Satan could not attack the Son of God, exalted to the Father's right hand. So does he accept his defeat? No, he does not. Although Satan, we should not say, is in any way wise, he is crafty. We should not say that he is smart. He has the stupidity of those who are blinded by sin. But he reasons it out this way. This is how I would see this. Okay, the head is beyond me. I cannot in any way defeat the head of the church, Christ. But what good is a head without a body? Yes, he's in heaven victorious, but if I can destroy his body on earth, I can still thwart the purposes of God. I can still get victory out of defeat. And so he turns his rage upon the church. He turns his rage upon the woman in this vision, who is a symbol of the church. And in chapter 12, the woman is the believing remnant of Israel, the true church that has always existed among Israel, though many of them were not truly saved. And it is through this woman, the true believing church of the Old Testament, that the Son of God was born. That is, through a woman like Mary, and also like her cousin Elizabeth, who brought John the Baptist into the world. And a man like Joseph, and Simeon, and Anna. And this picture that we receive in the New Testament of the believing remnant through whom Christ came. And so his hatred now turns on that believing remnant. Of course, that remnant is expanded. We find it in the 12 apostles. Judas fell, but Matthias was put in his place. We have this core, this of the believing Jewish church that has now been given the Great Commission to go out into all the world and preach the gospel, and the devil is determined to stop them. And so we see his persecution of the Judean church, of the Jews who are truly followers of the Lord, who are disciples of Jesus Christ. But at the end of chapter 12, we see that he was thwarted in that attempt. And that the Jewish church, the believing church of Israel, fulfilled its commission. And they planted the church in all the world. They did the work of God. Satan couldn't stop them. And then in his last-ditch attempt to use the Romans to wipe out every Jew there was in Palestine, he failed there, and God protected the Judean church, even in that circumstance. So what do we have next? This is where we pick it up. And, okay, we have that narrative in the vision, and what now? And the dragon was wroth with the woman. He was enraged and angry that he was not able to defeat the woman, that is, the believing remnant of Israel that brought forth Christ and then was the commissioned body to bring forth or to found the New Testament church. He wasn't able to defeat them. So what does he do now? He turns upon, we're told here, the remnant of her seed, the rest of her seed, which keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. And so the woman, remember, in this chapter, chapter 12, is the church of the Old Testament that brought forth the Messiah, the Messianic community. But this church is not only the mother of the Messiah, this church is the mother of the New Testament church. And so the rest of her seed refers to the New Testament church that she planted. But this is not in this chapter now, as we come to chapter 13. The remnant of her seed, I believe, refers to the believing Gentiles and Jews in one body outside of Judea. The churches that were planted in obedience to the Great Commission. The Great Commission, as recorded for us in Acts chapter 1, verse 8, he said, "You shall receive power after the Holy Spirit comes upon you. And you shall be my witnesses in Judea, in Samaria, and in Jerusalem, in Judea, in Samaria, and unto the uttermost part of the world." So he tried to defeat the church in Jerusalem, Judea, and Samaria, and he couldn't. So now where does he turn? To the church that's been planted in the uttermost parts of the earth. That is the uttermost parts of the earth of that time, the Roman Empire. And so that's what we come to in chapter 13. We move from Judea and the attack upon the Judean church to Satan's attack upon the Gentile church in the Roman Empire. That's a little bit different perspective than maybe you've heard. Most people, when they come to chapter 13, think we're talking about the end times. That we're talking about some kind of future Antichrist and the church of the end times. But that is not the stated frame of reference for the book of Revelation. The book of Revelation deals with visions and revelations that have to do with things which must shortly come to pass because the time is at hand. And when John wrote this book, there was something very shortly to come to pass that would affect the Gentile churches in the Roman Empire, which, by the way, remember the book was written to seven churches, originally addressed to seven churches in Asia Minor, not churches in Judea. This is a chapter to speak to them. It's to prepare them. The other chapters were explaining the judgment of God upon Jerusalem and Judea and were fortifying the Judean church. This chapter is given to fortify the Gentile church and for the fiery trial that they are about to undergo, the fiery trial that Peter spoke about in his first epistle. The time of distress that Paul spoke about in 1 Corinthians 7 that was about to come on the earth. And he said it's not good to be married because of what's going to be coming upon the churches. So this is what we come to then in chapter 13. We're moving on from Judea to the Roman Empire. But we're still within the same time frame, the first century church, prior to the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. These are words to strengthen them concerning the persecution that is about to fall upon the church. Now, as we study a chapter like this and we understand its historical reference point, the anchor of exegesis is the history in which it took place. That does not mean that this doesn't speak to us with power today as well. It does. For what has taken place and what is predicted here within the context of John's revelation about the persecution of the Gentile church is still happening today. The devil is still after the body of Christ. He's still persecuting the church in the Gentile lands. And that's happening right here. And so what we see here, as it applies to the first century church in the Roman Empire, reveals the plans and purposes of Satan, how God sustains his people, and what the true context is of our battle today. Why are we being persecuted? Who is behind it? And so remember, there's rich theology, rich practical instruction. Revelation is like any other book in the Bible. We interpret it in its historical context. And when we understand that, we're able to extrapolate from it the principles, the doctrines, the truth that is contained therein and how it manifested itself then and see how it applies to us today. So the book of Revelation is not an end times book. The only end times in the book of Revelation is the end of the Judaic age, the end of the temple, the end of Jerusalem. But it actually is giving to you and I here doctrine we need to walk in the world in which we're in today. For what happened in the first century is happening today. It happened since then till today. But let's look at their story. Let's look what they had to face and understand this passage then within its context. Chapter 13 and verse 1. Oh, by the way, before I go to that, there's one thing I forgot to say yet. Notice the remnant of her seed, that is the Christian church, in Gentile lands, is defined. You want to know what it is to be part of, to be a church, to be a Christian? To be a Christian is to keep the commandments of God. Do you see that? The remnant of her seed, let's define who we're talking about. We're talking about those who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. In other words, the law of God and the gospel of God. The law of God and the gospel of Christ. True believers seek to obey God's commandments and to testify of the gospel. It's a pretty basic and simple definition of what it means to be a Christian. Keep the commandments of God and have that testimony of Jesus Christ in your life and on your lips. That's what it means to be a Christian. So what happens to such Christians in this context in the first century world? Well, now we have the continuation of the vision. And I stood upon the sand of the sea and saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and upon his horns 10 crowns. And upon his heads the name of blasphemy. And the beast which I saw was like unto a leopard, and his feet were as the feet of a bear, and his mouth as the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him his power, and his seat, and great authority. And I saw one of his heads, as it were, wounded to death. And his deadly wound was healed, and all the world wondered after the beast. And they worshipped the dragon, which gave power unto the beast, and they worshipped the beast, saying, Who is like unto the beast? Who is able to make war with him? And there was given unto him a mouth, speaking great things and blasphemies. And power was given unto him to continue 42 months. And he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God, to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle and them that dwell in heaven. And it was given unto him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And power was given him over all kindreds and tongues and nations. And all that dwell upon the earth shall worship him, whose names are not written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. If any man have an ear, let him hear. He that leadeth into captivity shall go into captivity. He that killeth with the sword must be killed with the sword. Here is the patience and the faith of the saints. Now, if you look at your back of your bulletin there for an outline of this chapter and the section that we're studying in this third interlude, we're looking at the two beasts in this section, beginning with the transition verse there in chapter 12, verse 17, through the end of the chapter. The first part I've just explained, which is the dragon's persecution of the remnant of the woman's seed, or the Gentile church in the Roman Empire. But then we come to verses 1 to 10. This is our text today. The dragon's primary agent in the persecution. So we have the dragon making war with the remnant of her seed. Through whom is he going to wage that war? Who will be the agent employed by Satan to persecute the church? Well, it's the beast. Notice there in verse 7, and it was given unto him, that is the beast, to make war with the saints. There's the connection. Verse 17, he goes forth to make war with the saints. Who does he use? Verse 7 of the next chapter, it was given unto the beast, him, to make war with the saints. So that's what we're talking about. The persecution of the church and the one that is the agent. And the agent, and I'm calling here the primary agent because I believe this chapter reveals two agents. The second agent is revealed in verses 11 to 17. But the primary agent is the beast from the sea. The secondary agent is the beast from the land or from the earth. That's 11 to 17. Five things I want us to note here. First of all, we're going to see the description of the beast in verses 1 to 3. Second, the worship of the dragon and the beast in verse 4. And then the war of the beast against God and the saints, verses 5 to 7. And then a warning to the saints not to yield to the demand to worship the beast. That's in verses 8 and 9. And then we have the judgment on their persecutors and the patience of the saints. And so let's look now at this, the dragon's persecution of the remnant through his primary agent, the beast from the sea. Does that make sense? Hopefully you see the flow here then. John says here now, as he continues to describe his vision, he says, I stood upon the sand of the sea. Now, the vision which began in chapter 12, we're just told that John said he saw a great wonder in heaven. We are not told specifically where he was located. But the vision that he received in the first part, chapter 12, was something he saw in the sky. Our supposition then will be that he was on the land and that probably the vision was about the church in Judea and therefore he was standing somewhere in that region. But now we're told that he specifically is standing beside the sea. Or to put it this way, upon the sand. That is the seashore, the sand that is on the seashore of the sea. And this would be the sea that we call the Mediterranean Sea. Palestine's bordered the Mediterranean Sea, and this was on its western border. We're also told that as he begins to describe the beast, that he saw a beast rise up out of the sea. And so in other words, he's looking west. If he looked east, he would see the land, but he looks west because he sees something coming out of the sea, a beast rising up out of the sea. Now, as we come to this, our minds need to go, our thoughts back to Daniel 7, which I would invite you just to look there with me, because a very similar thing is given here. Chapter 7 of Daniel. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions. Every same thing. Visions of his head upon his bed. Then he wrote the dream and told the sum of the matter. Daniel spoke and said, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of the heaven strove upon the great sea. The great sea was the Mediterranean back then. And four beasts came up from the sea. Sound familiar? We just read in Revelation. Four beasts, though, here, one in Revelation. But four beasts came up from the sea, diverse one from another. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings, and I beheld till the wings thereof were plucked and was lifted up from the earth and made to stand upon the feet as a man, and heart was given unto it. And behold, another beast, a second, like a bear, and raised up itself on one side. It had three ribs in the mouth of it, between the teeth of it. And they said thus unto it, arise and devour much flesh. If this shall be held, and lo, another, like a leopard, which had upon the back of it four wings of a fowl. The beast had also four heads, and dominion was given to it. And after this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible and strong exceedingly. And it had great iron teeth. It devoured and broke in pieces and stamped the residue with the feet of it. And it was diverse from all the beasts that were before it. And it had 10 horns. And then he goes on to describe those horns. Now, do you see the similarity here on this? Beasts rising out of the sea. In Daniel, there are four beasts. And these four beasts, and by the way, if you'd like to explore this a little bit further, you can go to Sermon Audio and my sermons on Daniel, where I deal with this chapter in detail. But let's just summarize real quick here. These beasts that Daniel sees rising out of the sea in succession Each represented a kingdom that was a world power that ruled over many nations. First of all, the first beast was Babylon, the second Medo-Persia, the third Greece, and the fourth in the vision of Daniel was the kingdom of Rome. And so we see the same type of imagery in Revelation 13. And so the beast that John sees in his vision is representing a great world power, just as those coming from the sea in Daniel did. And if we stay within the stated time limits of the book of Revelation, it seems clear that the world power in view in John's vision is Imperial Rome that ruled the world at the time that Revelation was written. It was near the height of its power at that time. And as we already noted, John stood on the shore of the Mediterranean Sea, meaning he was looking west, and Rome was west of Palestine. And it was surrounded, the isthmus of Italy, where it was surrounded by the sea. This is a picture of Rome in Revelation 13. As in Daniel, these are spoken of as beasts. The Greek word for beast here in our vision is a wild beast, a deadly monster, one that you would not want to have to deal with. And if you remember, the wild beasts of Daniel 7 were a lion with eagle's wings, a bear raised up on one side with three ribs in its mouth, a leopard with four wings, and then a dreadful and terrible beast. Notice in our vision here, in verse 2, that the beast that he sees was like a leopard. And its feet were as the feet of a bear, and its mouth was like the mouth of a lion. You see all three of those that were in the Daniel vision? Lion, bear, and leopard. But the fourth beast of Daniel is not depicted here because the fourth beast of Daniel is the beast of Revelation 13, 1 and following. This is Rome. And this vision of Rome, we are told, as the division continues to be described, has seven heads. This beast of Rome has seven heads and 10 horns, and upon his horns, 10 crowns. Now that description is very similar to the vision of the red dragon. Not exactly the same, but very similar. Chapter 12, verse 3. Remember that vision? And there appeared another wonder in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon having 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 crowns upon his head. Now, this description of the beast in verse 2 here, like a leopard, feet as a bear, mouth as a lion, and a dragon, gave him the power, also had, like the dragon, 7 heads and 10 horns. Now, look over with me to Revelation 17. For this same beast is the subject of concern in chapter 17. Of Revelation. Just want to pick out a couple of verses. My point is not to go into detail with chapter 17, but just to show you there's some further information on this beast given in chapter 17. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet-colored beast, full of names of blasphemy, and having 7 heads and 10 horns. Now look with me in this same chapter to verse 7. And the angel said unto me, wherefore dost thou marvel? I will tell thee the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which has 7 heads and 10 horns. The beast that thou sawest was and is not, and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition. And they that dwell in the earth shall wonder, whose names were not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they behold the beast that was and is not and yet is. Here is the mind that has wisdom. The 7 heads are 7 mountains upon which the woman sits. There are 7 kings. 5 are fallen, and 1 is, and the other is not yet to come. When he cometh, he must continue a short space. And the beast that was and is not, even is he is the 8th, and is of the 7, and goeth into perdition. And the 10 horns which thou sawest are 10 kings, which have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. These have one mind and shall give their power and strength unto the beast, and they shall make war with the Lamb. This is the same beast that we're looking at in our passage here. And again, I'm not going to explain this in detail. We'll wait there. But there's one thing we need to understand. And both of these tell us there are seven heads. And when we come to the time frame in which this book was written, we know that these seven heads are the seven heads of Rome, or the seven Caesars or emperors of the Roman Empire. And there were seven up to this point when John wrote. Here's how it would have fallen out. The first was Julius Caesar. The second, Augustus Caesar. The third, Tiberius Caesar. The fourth, Gaius Caesar. The fifth, Claudius Caesar. The sixth, Nero Caesar. And the seventh, Galba. And as it says here in chapter 17, Galba, and we'll again explain this more when we get to this chapter, only reigned for a few months. It was a time of civil war, and he was put down. That's why it says he must continue a short time. So what we have here in that chapter helps us understand that these seven heads are the seven emperors of Rome, as they are relevant to the time of the writing of the book of Revelation. For there were more emperors after AD 70. We're also told that the ten horns with ten crowns were ten kings who would receive power with the beast. In other words, these are kings, the rulers of the provinces and the kings that were conquered by Rome, who were now loyal to Rome and would be given power with Rome to fight against the Church of Jesus Christ, the saints. And so the vision is of the beast and the power of that beast as exercised through its emperors. That's the beast that we're looking at here. It is Rome and the power of Rome as exercised through its emperors. And so we need to note, this is very important for understanding the language as it describes the beast, is the beast is both Rome and the reigning Caesar. Because the reigning Caesar had complete power in Rome. And so sometimes the beast, we're thinking of the Roman Empire, other times we're thinking of the head of the Roman Empire, which is Caesar. Now we're told here that upon his heads, which would be the seven Caesars, they had names of blasphemy. This refers, no doubt, to the cult of emperor worship that arose in Rome. They declared that their emperors were gods. For example, the imperial coinage of Rome that was used throughout the empire, by the way, the coinage was their means of propaganda. They didn't have internets and magazines and newspapers and television, but the coins went throughout the world. It was their way of propagandizing their subjects. And on the coins, they would have images of the reigning Caesar, and over the head or somewhere on the coin or on the obverse of the coin, they would either have the title Divus, which in Latin means divine, or Theos, which in Greek means God. And so they would take the images of the Caesars and they would put on their heads, as it were, the declaration that they were divine beings, or to use the Greek term, they were gods. Blasphemy on their heads. It's a picture of the Roman coins. It was their belief that Caesar is divine, that Caesar is God. And this blasphemous claim was inspired and given power by the dragon, as we're told in verse 2. And the dragon gave him his power and his seat and his great authority. The source of Rome's military power would be the idea that he gave him power. Where did the military might of Rome come from? Well, from the dragon. What about his throne? That is, the word seat can be translated throne. The kingdom of the Caesars, where did it come from? From the dragon. And the great authority referred to their absolute tyranny over the world, absolute authority over the world, where their word was law. And this giving of this kind of power by the dragon to Rome goes back to the beginning of the empire under Julius Caesar in 49 to 44 BC. Which, by the way, Satan still had the power and authority to do that. Remember, he wasn't cast out of heaven until after found the Christ's victory in the founding of the church. So Rome arose in its power through satanic agency. And Satan was still very active in the world. Now, verse 3 is something interesting. I saw on his head as if one were wounded to death. In other words, John saw in the vision what would normally be considered a fatal wound to this beast, a visionary beast. This is all symbol and metaphor and vision. So in other words, the Roman Empire received what looked like a fatal wound. And yet, it didn't prove to be fatal to the empire. Maybe the emperor died. Maybe that was the fatal wound, the death of some emperor. But that death of one of the heads, which is wounded here, which does point that it was one of the Caesars, when it happened, everybody thought this is the end of Rome. They can't survive. And yet Rome did survive. In fact, Rome came back even stronger than before. Now, there's a widespread belief and agreement among commentators that the head in view that was wounded was Nero. That is, that was what happened with Nero, and he was when he committed suicide. And it brought the empire to the brink. A period of terrible internal strife followed Nero's suicide. And within the space of the year, there were three claimants to the throne. All three of them were put to death. And it looked like Rome was sinking. But then Vespasian, you've heard his name, he was the general that originally began the war for Rome in Judea. Vespasian then was declared emperor. And he restored the kingdom, and again, it was stronger than ever before under Vespasian. So some believe that the deadly wound was Nero's death and the civil wars that followed. Another view is that the head was Julius Caesar, and the deadly wound was when he was assassinated by Brutus. You know this story. Shakespeare. And that tells that in one of his plays. But that's an historical event. Julius Caesar was assassinated. He was the first emperor. And so the traditions of the emperor and the Caesars was very uncertain. And this, again, like the death of Nero, led to civil war in Rome. And all was in flux. All was in chaos for a season. The first emperor assassinated. Remember the dates of Julius Caesar. Were 44 BC is when he was killed. And that what's happening here in this picture is that death blow, so it looked like it would be the death blow of Rome. Actually, it wasn't. It was healed, and Rome went on. Here's what Milton Terry says about that view. In other words, two views. One, that it was Nero and his death, the civil war that follows. Other, that it was Julius Caesar and his assassination, the war that followed. Here's what Milton Terry says about the second. As the Roman dominion over Palestine is especially within the scope of this book, it was not irrelevant for the author to make a symbolic recognition of the grievous wound the empire received in this quarter during the civil wars and troubles that followed the assassination of Julius Caesar. At this time, the Parthians overran all Western Asia and Palestine and captured Jerusalem. This was truly a smiting of one of the strongholds of Roman supremacy, as if it were unto death, and erecting over Jerusalem for the time the dominion of a totally different world power. For a full year, says Rawlinson, Western Asia changed masters. The rule and authority of Rome disappeared, and the Parthians were recognized as the dominant power. End quote. But subsequent conquests of the Roman armies healed this notable wound of the empire, and her power over that land, that is, Judea, was restored again. So whatever view, I think I tend toward the second one myself, that it was Julius Caesar. But if you want to say it was Nero, it doesn't matter. The point is, one of the heads received what looked like a fatal wound to the empire, but the empire survived, even though it went through a period of civil war. And it came out even stronger. And that's why all the world, as it says there at the end of verse 3, wondered after the beast. I mean, Rome seemed invincible. It could even survive civil war. It was a mighty power. The world was awestruck as Rome pulled itself together and exerted with even greater fervor its power and authority over the nations. And this wandering after the beast leads us to the divisionary part where the worship, the beast is worshipped. As it says in verse 4. And they, that is the world that was wandering after the beast, they worshiped the dragon who gave power unto the beast, and they worshiped the beast, saying, who is like unto the beast? Who is able to make war with him? They're invincible. Rome's power was total, and the world fell in homage before Rome. And remember, they were calling for worship. Caesar is divine. Caesar is God. Or in another phrase that became the epitome of this blasphemy was Caesar is Lord. And it became the confession of faith of the empire if you were to, that you would bow down and say, Caesar is divine. Caesar is Lord. That was the worship that is being spoken of here. The people still had their gods that they worship, but they realized that the primary god was that of Caesar because that's where real power was. They went and looked at their images, and their images couldn't speak. Their images couldn't help them. Their images couldn't do anything. But they, in their folly, they still worship them. But Rome could. Rome had power. Rome had money. Rome had the sword. And so it became the object of men's worship. But again, this is not something that should surprise us. The homage and worship that was given to gods in the Old Covenant, Old Testament era, the histories of the Old Testament, is seen, for example, in the worship that was given to Pharaoh of Egypt. Pharaoh was considered the offspring of the gods and the representative of God on earth, and he was actually worshipped and claimed divine power. We see in the biblical story of Nebuchadnezzar, he was worshipped. He built an image to his glory and name, and now people were commanded to bow down and worship. But we have the three brave Hebrew youths says, we're not going to worship your image. We're not going to bow down to Babylon or to Nebuchadnezzar. We will serve you as we are able, our conscience allows us. We will give the proper respect to you as king, but we will not worship you. And so, this cult of emperor worship in Rome was actually built on a foundation that went back to the dawn of human time. That is, till the time when great empires arose. And people believed that these kings, these pharaohs, these Caesars, these emperors were the representative of God on earth. They were the connecting link between heaven and earth. And if you wanted to make well in this world, you needed to give honor and homage and worship to Caesar, to Pharaoh, to Nebuchadnezzar, or whatever other monarch who ruled over you, because they were the representation of God. So this idea of this worship. Remember when we studied the seven churches of Asia Minor? When we were talking about the church in Smyrna, we said this. Pergamos was not as prominent as Ephesus and Smyrna in some respects. But politically, it surpassed them as it was the capital of the Roman province of Asia and was the official center and stronghold for the imperial cult of emperor worship in Asia. This is Pergamos. It was the first city of Asia to receive permission from Rome to build a temple dedicated to the worship of the divine Augustus and the goddess Roma. And that was in 29 BC. So temples were built dedicated to this emperor cult and the worship of the emperor and the goddess who stood for Rome. That's the world in which they lived. And the church in Pergamos was warned and exhorted not to submit to that. And so they give worship, we're told here, toward Rome. Let's stop and look at the word worship real quickly. It's a compound word in Greek. Our English translation is worship. The actual word upon which that translation is based was a compound word in Greek. It meant to be near, towards, or in the presence of something. And the verb that was connected to that preposition originally meant to kiss. To kiss, the idea of what you kissed. It probably referred then originally, this Greek concept of worship, to the ancient practice of kissing an idol. Kissing an idol. They do that in Romanism today. They kiss their idols, their saints, don't they? Well, that's what this originally meant, to kiss an idol. But then that sort of fell into the background as the word was used and its use was expanded, and it came to the general meaning then of paying homage to or making obeisance to a god. Therefore, as we would call it and translate it here, to worship, to adore, to reverence, and give offerings to. The homage and the worship given to the gods is now also given to Rome and the emperor. But as I said, this was no new development in human history. You say, well, that's all interesting, but we've gone way beyond that. I mean, we can understand in the first century and all the heathenism and paganism in the world that there was this idea of emperor worship, but we're way beyond that. Oh, are we? We might use different terms. We might look at it in different forms, but how does God see it? What is actually happening today? You know that it's still the same that people reverence and pay homage to power, don't they? They give reverence to wealth. And this is what most modern states possess: power and wealth. But where does their power come through? Their power comes by their claim to be the source of law. Their power comes through their military and police force that awes people you do not want to mess with. Their power comes through the printing of money, which is a tyrannical act, where the state then controls the value of the means of exchange. They get wealthy through taxation, confiscation of property, and so on. In fact, Hegel, the philosopher, not very long ago, said this. Very influential, Hegel. He said, the state is God walking on earth. This wasn't written in the first century. Written in the 19th century. Or thereabouts. I can't remember now exactly Hegel's dates. And that's the way people look at it. The state is God working on earth. Because there's power. There's wealth. If you really want to make it in the world, you've got to bow to the deity of the modern state. Rush Dooney famously said that the source of law in a society is the god of that society. Whoever you recognize as the source of law, ultimate source of law, is your god. In the Roman Empire, they realized Rome's word was law. They were God. It used to be in this country that God was our god, because we recognize the ultimate source of law in America was the living God as revealed in His Word. That men don't make law. All we can do is try to understand it and apply it. But that has changed today. The God of the United States, I'm sorry to say today, because we can tell by who's the source of law, is the state. The state makes law. It doesn't care what God's law says. There was one representative in Washington who dared to read from the scriptures in a debate over abortion. And I can't think of it. Clark, what was the one who stood up against him? Huh?
James Redd.
What?
I'm not sure.
Okay. I can't think of his name. He's one of the Democrats. After this man gave this speech and said that we should be under the law of God and get our understanding of abortion from the law of God, he stood up and said, "This Congress recognizes no deity. We will not submit to the law of any God." In other words, we're God. We're our own God. We determine good and evil for ourselves. But do you want to know something here about such a state as Rome, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, other modern states, and sadly to a large degree even ours today? You know what the Bible calls such a state? A beast. It's a beast. It's not your friend. Beasts devour. Beasts destroy. Beasts look for prey. They're not there to protect anyone. They're there for their own reason. The tyrannical state, according to Scripture, is a beast. A wild beast to be feared in the sense of not allowing your country to become such a tyranny, such a state. But the problem is that we see today is in our country, this happening. The state has become the source of our security, our welfare, our money, our future, our social security, and the things that God says are His. Remember, Jesus says, "Render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar, and to God the things that are God's." What has happened when you have a tyrannical beast-like state? They don't just say, "Render unto Caesar the things that be Caesar's." They say, "Render unto Caesar the things that be Caesar, and render unto Caesar anything that you think belongs to a God, because we are God walking on earth." We're in a serious situation. Our country, which once was governed by a godly republic, by and large, is turning into a beast. It will devour us. And as this chapter shows us, will persecute the church. Because all of these beasts, all of these tyrannies are inspired by who, according to this passage? What's the theology of the passage? It comes from the dragon, the devil. He inspires tyranny. Liberty comes from Christ. Tyranny comes from the devil. And when you are in a country that is becoming more and more given over to tyranny and absolute power, absolute lawmaking, and the determining of the lives of the citizens by means of the state, you are turning your country is becoming a beast that will devour you. Civil government is God's idea. I am not anti-state, but I am anti-beast-like state. Amen. In Romans 13, Paul counsels and teaches concerning the fact that the civil government is a divine institution. It was given by God to restrain evil. Some people have said, well, look at the difference between Paul in Romans 13 calling the state the servant of God and John calling it the beast. And they're both talking about the same government. Paul was under the Romans when he wrote that, but things had changed since Paul wrote. When Paul wrote Romans, the civil government of Rome was actually protecting Christians. Paul found a shield from the murderous fanaticism of the Jews. They protected him. They rescued him from the mob. And Rome was in some ways at that point friendly to the church, and at least in the sense that they protected them and were fulfilling God's purpose. But by the time we get to this stage of the Revelation, at the end of the New Testament era, Rome is declared a beast. And so this beast is supreme. And what do people do? They're beaten. And they say, "Who's like unto the beast? Who can make war with him? We're done. I mean, we just got to submit. There's nothing else we can do. They're too powerful." That's what happens. Now, verses 5 through 7, we have the war of the beast against God and his saints. "And there was given unto him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and power was given unto him to continue 42 months. He opened his mouth in blasphemy against God to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle and them that dwell in heaven. And it was given unto him to make war with the saints and to overcome them, and power was given him over all kindreds, tongues, and nations." There's two things that are given unto him. And the one giving unto them is the one who gives power to the beast, as we saw that, is the dragon. And I believe this idea of given here is in the sense of inspiring them, moving them in this course of action, and backing them up as they seek to do it with all of his evil forces and powers at his command. But there's two things that are said here. There was given unto the beast, which is Rome and its reigning emperor, two things: to blaspheme the true God, and secondly, to make war against the saints. Blasphemy against God, persecution of the church. Now notice how this goes together. We're told here in verse 5, and there was given unto him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies. That's the first thing that was given him. Notice verse 6 then explains those blasphemies. And he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God, to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle and them that dwell in heaven. Pretty comprehensive blasphemy against God, to speak against God, speak things that bring down God's honor and glory. But it also says was given unto him power to continue for 42 months. What does that mean? It's explained in verse 7. The power that was given to the beast for 42 months was the power to make war with the saints. That's the power. See, two things: blasphemy and persecution. Introduced in verse 5. The blasphemy explained in verse 6. The 42 months of persecution is explained in verse 7. And so for 42 months, it was given unto him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And power was given him over all kindred, tongues, and nations. And so the beast, who in this context is Nero, as the Caesar, was given power to blaspheme God. He was inspired of Satan. That's the kind of power we're talking about here. Inspired of Satan to blaspheme God and moved by Satan with the power that he had as the Roman emperor to make war with the saints, that is, God's people, the New Testament church, the seed, the remnant of her seed, the Gentile church in Roman lands. Verse 17 of the previous chapter, the dragon went out to make war against the church. Verse 7 of chapter 12, the instrument of making that war is the beast, because it says it was given him to make war with the saints. And the saints are those who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. So that's what we're talking about here. Notice that in the persecution, he had power to overcome them. This means there were casualties in the church. God, in his own purpose, allowed the persecution of the beast, of Nero, to overcome the saints. Many of them died. Others were banished. Others were tortured. Others lost their property. Various ways in which this persecution came down, but it was a dreadful persecution. And God, for his own purposes, allowed it. Satan inspired it, and God allowed it. This was a terrible persecution where many were overcome, killed, arrested, and so on. And the power of persecution was not limited to Rome itself, but the power given to the beast, Nero as the head of that beast, was to persecute the church in all kindreds, tongues, and nations of the Roman Empire. The persecution was not limited to Rome itself, that is, the city of Rome, but it was out through all the earth. Now, I'd like you to look at your insert, your bulletin there, please. I know my limitations, and I'm not very eloquent. And when I looked and was reading over this persecution, how do I present this in a way that has a power and moving description? And I found it. In Philip Schaff's volume 1 of his History of the Christian Church, which I do recommend. And so what I have for you there some excerpts from his history. And these excerpts deal with the Nero, the beast's head that we're talking about in chapter 13. These excerpts are the explanation of the war of Nero against the saints and how he overcame them. That is, how he persecuted them. Does that make sense, what we're talking about here? Nero and his persecution of the Christians. This was the first persecution, official persecution of Rome against Christianity. I'm going to read this. It's long, but I say it's better than my words, and I want you to follow along so you see the power of this. His first section is about Nero. That's the beast that's in view. That is the head of the beast, Nero, at the time John wrote, and who is the one who is doing this persecuting. Reading now from Schaff. The first of these imperial persecutions, with which the martyrdom of Peter and Paul is connected by ecclesiastical tradition, took place in the 10th year of Nero's reign, AD 64. And by the instigation of that very emperor to whom Paul, as a Roman citizen, had appealed from the Jewish tribunal. It was, however, not a strictly religious persecution like those under the later emperors. It originated in a public calamity, the great fire which consumed the city of Rome, which was wantonly charged upon the innocent Christians. A greater contrast can hardly be imagined than that between Paul, one of the purest and noblest of men, and Nero, one of the basest and vilest of tyrants. The glorious first 5 years of Nero's reign, 54 to 59, under the wise guidance of Seneca and Burrus, make the other nine, 59 to 68, only more hideous by contrast. We read his life with mingled feelings of contempt for his folly and horror for his wickedness. The world was to him a comedy and a tragedy in which he was to be the chief actor. He had an insane passion for popular applause. He played on the lyre. He sung his odes at supper. He drove his chariots in the circus. He appeared as a mimic on the stage and compelled men of the highest rank to represent in dramas or in tableau the obscenest of the Greek myths. But the comedian was surpassed by the tragedian. He heaped crime upon crime until he became a proverbial monster of iniquity. The murder of his brother, Britannicus, his mother, get this down, he murdered his brother and he murdered his mother, Agrippina, his wives, Octavia and Poppaea, his teacher, Seneca, and many eminent Romans was fitly followed by his suicide in the 32nd year of his age. With him, the family of Julius Caesar ignominiously perished, and the empire became the prize of successful soldiers and adventurers. He continues, the conflagration in Rome. For such a demon in human shape. Now notice these, by the way, I'm going to pause. Notice his statements to spiritual wickedness and demonic and the dragon and devilish. He's explaining for us here, chapter 13. Who's moving Nero to these things? The dragon. He says, for such a demon in human shape, the murder of a crowd of innocent Christians was pleasant sport. The occasion of the hellish spectacle was a fearful conflagration of Rome, the most destructive and disastrous that ever occurred in history. It broke out in the night between the 18th and 19th of July, AD 64, among the wooden shops in the southeastern end of the Great Circus near the Palatine Hill. Lashed by the wind, it defied all exertions of the firemen and soldiers and raged with unabated fury for 7 nights and 6 days. Then it burst out again in another part, near the Field of Mars, and in 3 days more laid waste 2 other districts of the city. The calamity was incalculable. Only 4 of the 14 regions into which the city was divided remain uninjured. 3, including the whole interior city from the circus to the Esquiline Hill, was a shapeless mass of ruins. The remaining 7 were more or less destroyed. Venerable temples, monumental buildings of the royal, republican, and imperial times, the richest creation of Greek art, which had been collected for centuries, were turned into dust and ashes. Men and beasts perished in the flames, and the metropolis of the world assumed the aspect of a graveyard, with 1 million of mourners over the loss of irreparable treasures. The cause of the conflagration is involved in mystery. Public rumor traced it to Nero, who wished to enjoy the lurid spectacle of burning Troy and to gratify his ambition to rebuild Rome on a more magnificent scale and call it Neropolis. When the fire broke out, he was on the seashore at Antium, his birthplace. He returned when the devouring element reached his own palace and made extraordinary efforts to stay and then to repair the disaster by a reconstruction which continued till after his death, not forgetting to replace his partially destroyed temporary residence by the Golden House as a standing wonder of the architectural magnificence and extravagance. Now, that leads us to the persecution. That's the background we need. Who Nero was and the conflagration of Rome. And now Schaff brings these together. To divert from himself the general suspicion of incendiarism, which would be we would call arson, and at the same time to furnish new entertainment for his diabolical cruelty, Nero wickedly cast the blame upon the hated Christians, who meanwhile, especially since the public trial of Paul and his successful labors in Rome, had come to be distinguished from the Jews as a genus tertium, or, this is what that means, the most dangerous offshoot from that race. They were certainly, this is the Christians he's describing, as the Romans saw them, they were certainly despisers of the Roman gods and the loyal subjects of a higher king than Caesar. And they were falsely suspected of secret crimes. The police and the people, under the influence of the panic created by the awful calamity, were ready to believe the worst slanders and demanded victims. Sound familiar? Modern? What could be expected of the ignorant multitude when even such cultivated Romans as Tacitus, Suetonius, and Pliny stigmatized Christians as a vulgar and pestiferous superstition? It appeared to them even worse than Judaism, which was at least an ancient natural or national religion, while Christianity was novel, detached from any particular nationality and aiming at universal dominion. Some Christians were arrested, confessed their faith, and were convicted, not so much, says Tacitus, of crime of incendiarism, as of hating the human race. Their Jewish origin, their indifference to politics and public affairs, their abhorrence of heathen customs were construed into an odium generis humani, that is, a class that hated the human race. And this made an attempt on their part to destroy the city sufficiently plausible to justify a verdict of guilty. An infuriated mob does not stop to reason and is apt to run mad as an individual. Under this wanton charge of incendiarism, backed by the equally groundless charge of misanthropy, that is, hating mankind, and unnatural vice, there began a carnival of blood such as even heathen Rome never saw before or since. In the answer of the powers of hell to the mighty preaching of the two chief apostles, which had shaken heathenism to its center, a vast multitude of Christians was put to death in the most shocking manner. Some were crucified, probably in mockery of the punishment of Christ. Some sewed up in the skins of wild animals and exposed to the voracity of mad dogs in the arena. The satanic tragedy reached its climax at night in the imperial gardens on the slope of the Vatican, which embraced, it is supposed, the present site of the palace and the church of St. Peter. Christian men and women, covered with pitch or oil or resin and nailed to posts of pine, were lighted and burned as torches for the amusement of the mob, while Nero, in fantastical dress, figured in a horse race and displayed his art as a charioteer. Burning alive was the ordinary punishment of incendiarism, but only the cruel ingenuity of this imperial monster under the inspiration of the devil could invent such a horrible system of illumination. This is the account of the greatest heathen historian, Tacitus. It's the fullest we have, as the best description of the destruction of Jerusalem is from the pen of the learned Jewish historian, Josephus. Thus, enemies bear witness to the truth of Christianity. Tacitus incidentally mentions in this connection the crucifixion of Christ under Pontius Pilate in the reign of Tiberius. With all his haughty Roman contempt, For the Christians, whom he knew only from rumor and reading, he was convinced of their innocence of incendiarism. And notwithstanding his cold stoicism, he could not suppress a feeling of pity for them, because they were sacrificed not to the public good, but to the ferocity of a wicked tyrant. End quote. And then he adds this interesting note. It is not unlikely that in this, as in all previous persecutions and often afterwards, the fanatical Jews, enraged by the rapid progress of Christianity and anxious to avert suspicion from themselves, stirred up the people against the hated Galileans, and that the heathen Romans fell with double fury on these supposed half-Jews disowned by their own strange brethren. End of quote. There, my friends, is a wonderful commentary on the historical realities in the vision of chapter 13. And so read verse 7 in a new light. And there was given unto him, that is Nero, to make war with the saints and to overcome them. Look at all the ways in which he overcame them and put them to death and tortured them. And the power was given to him over all kindred, tongues, and nations. But this leads to this thought. And all that dwell upon the earth shall worship him. Who? Nero, the beast, Rome, the emperor and the goddess Roma. They'll worship him, whose names are not written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. If any man have an ear to hear, let him hear. By the way, I failed to mention back to verse 5 when we saw that this time of persecution and overcoming them was 42 months. Verse 5. That's interesting because we saw in chapter 11, verses 2 to 3, that the war, the Jewish-Roman war, would last 42 months. Remember that, chapter 11? Were 3.5 years. And we saw that that period of time of the Jewish-Roman war was counted from the entrance of Vespasian with the Roman armies into Galilee in March, April, AD 67, till the fall of Jerusalem, September 26, AD 70, a period of 42 months. Are these the same 42 months in view? Well, looking at the context of chapter 11 and 13, I don't think they are. Some answer this by saying the 42 months became a stereotyped time frame to speak of suffering and calamity. It could be. But you know what's interesting? You know how long the persecution under Nero lasted? According to historical records, 42 months. It began right after the fire that we read about in Rome, November AD 64. And it continued until sometime before Nero's death. Of course, his death was a suicide, and his power had broken down maybe in the couple months before that. But what we have from AD November AD 64, the middle or end of that November, to sometime before his suicide in the beginning of June, is a period of 42 months. And so what we see here, for some reason, the war lasted 42 months, the persecution also lasted 42 months, according to historical sources. And so the beast is this agent of Satan to make war on the Gentile church in the Roman Empire. And the head of the beast in that era, in that time, was Nero. He was this, as Schaff describes him, a demonic individual. Schaff was cautious in his description. You can go back and read Suetonius, and it should be X-rated reading when you hear about how gross, how animalistic, how immoral, how wicked Nero was in his later years. They say the first few years he was pretty good under Seneca, the wise philosopher and teacher, but he became a demonic type figure because the devil, the dragon, gave him his power. And as this evil, mad tyrant who becomes the first in a long line of evil, mad tyrants who have shed the blood of the saints and persecuted the people of God. And in God's sometimes inscrutable purposes, he was allowed to overcome them. But notice, it was only for a season. Persecution is always limited by God's providence. God in his purposes allowed this persecution for 42 months. But then it was over. In fact, Vespasian and his son Titus, who followed him on the Roman throne, did not persecute the Christians. Titus, in fact, was quite positive toward the Christians. And so it ended, but it came up later. But it ended then. Look at history and the persecutions of the church, the Spanish Inquisition and the like. They had a beginning. They overcame for a season, but then it had an end. And so remember that in times of persecution, there's limits, time-wise. There's limits as to what they're able to do. But what we have in verses 8 and 9 is a warning to Christians that in the time of persecution, not to yield to the demand of worshiping Caesar, not to yield to the demand of worshiping the state, which the tyrannical state always calls upon you to do, to give it ultimate allegiance. Is another way to talk about worship. We give ultimate allegiance to our God. And many tyrants, in fact, Rome was very good at that. You could worship all the gods you wanted. They even supported that type of thing. But it had to be, it was understood that those gods were not Lord. Caesar is Lord. And this was the test that came upon Christians. Then, and as it developed, they could worship this Jesus if they wanted to. But they had to come and show their devotion. And this is a test that developed a little bit later. But the peoples of the empire had to show their devotion by coming to a little image of Caesar and giving a pinch of incense as an offering and make a declaration. Caesar is Lord. And once you did that, you got your vaccination card. Oh, no, excuse me. You got your you got your certificate from the state that you were a good citizen. So Christians, this was the challenge. And they had their life and their well-being hung on it. And you can see the pressure. Okay, you know, just say Caesar is Lord. I don't really mean it. I'll just say it and go on with life. But that's not how it works. That was a declaration of lordship. Official legal declaration of who your Lord ultimately was. And that meant if Caesar's law and Christ's law conflicted, who was Lord? Whose law did you follow? Caesar's, because Caesar is Lord. Christ is a demigod. He's a lesser Lord. It's okay if you want to call him Lord, but you got to remember it's ultimately Caesar. And so Christians refused to say that. They refused to do that. And the first persecution had the elements of Caesar's Nero's demonic purposes, and perhaps he burnt Rome himself and put the blame on Christians, false flag actions, those type of things. See, things don't change, do they? And the mob gets stirred up and they demand victims, and nobody uses any reason or any thought because people want blood. We see this happening in the Middle East right now. There's no reasoning going on. Blood was shed, we must have blood in return. And no reason, no restraint. It happens all the time. Who's stirring all that up, by the way? The same dragon is the one that's stirring that up. But the Christians were put on notice. And they would not worship Caesar. They would obey him in lawful commands, but they would not worship and give ultimate allegiance to Caesar. Who did? This is the warning. The ones who did give ultimate allegiance to Caesar, the ones who did say Caesar is Lord, verse 8, were the ones whose name is not written in the book of life. They're not saved. They're not the elect. They're not true Christians. So you can see the warning that John's laying out here to them and to us, if we're put in a similar situation. To make that confession, to worship the beast, is to show that you are not, you never were, written in the Lamb's book of life. You're a false Christian. And that's why it says, if any man have an ear, let him hear. Do not submit to the tyranny of the state in such worship, such reverence. But here's the patience of the saints, and to remember this, and we close on this. He that leads into captivity shall go into captivity, and he that killeth with the sword must be killed with the sword. Who's he talking about? Well, there's two main ways of persecution. Captivity or banishment. In fact, John, when he wrote Revelation, was banished on the Isle of Patmos, probably during the persecution in the provinces set off by Nero. He had been led into captivity. He was put in prison. We saw in the church, letters to the churches, some of you Satan will cast into prison. And that's persecution sometimes, imprisonment, banishment, and the like. But it also was killed with the sword. Killed by the sword of the state, either through those heinous means that Nero devised or literally with the sword. And so the ones who are leading the saints into captivity themselves will have that visit upon them in due time. They'll go into captivity as a judgment for persecuting God's people. This is the Old Testament doctrine that those who persecute the people of God, who dig pits for the righteous to fall into, will eventually fall into the pit themselves. And those who kill with the sword must be killed with the sword. How did Nero's life end? He was a coward, but he knew they were coming for him and they were going to abuse him and he was going to be murdered. So he took out his stiletto, his little sword, and he helped, but he couldn't put it through his throat himself, so he asked a slave that was with him to help his hand and guide it. And he ran the sword into his own throat. So the one who killed the Christians in such horrific way perished by his own hand, thrusting his own sword into his miserable neck. That's what this is saying, and this is where the patience of the saints come in. Don't worry. Your persecutors are defeated foes. And when their time is up, they will perish in the very ways that they brought upon you. Hold fast, my dear Christian. Do not yield to the worship of the beast. The patience of the saints is to endure persecution and to be faithful to the end. And they're the ones whose names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life. Remember the letters to the churches? He that endures to the end. What was that phrase? To him that overcometh. I will give this. Overcoming this type of thing. Overcoming this persecution. Overcoming the world's hatred. If any man have an ear to hear, let him hear today. Amen. And so Revelation 13 is not about the end times and a future Antichrist. It's about the crucial times in which John wrote the book of Revelation. It was prior to the destruction of Jerusalem. These times, the transition from Old Testament to New Testament, the founding of the church, and the overthrow of the Old Testament system of typology is of incredible importance. And the vision that we see in chapter 12 and 13 deal with the spiritual war of that era. The war of the dragon against the Judean church, and then the war of the dragon against the Gentile church that was established throughout the lands. And as we continue in Revelation, we will see, even greater than this, the victory of Christ. Amen. Lord, bless this sermon, this teaching, as it is according to your word. Amen.